Well, did you ever catch a fish and wonder, I wonder how old this fish is? Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Reggie McLeod back with us, editor and publisher of Big River Magazine. We talk with him every so often to find out what's going on in the driftless area of the Mississippi. And today we'll talk about some new dating techniques that are being used on fish. That's a story in the latest issue. We'll talk about what happens to sand dredged from the Mississippi and other news from Wisconsin's West Coast. So, do you live along the Big River? What topics are on your mind? They cover a lot of them in Big River Magazine. Always fun to hear from Reggie and to hear from you. So I hope you'll join in with your questions or comments or maybe experiences. Number to call 1-800-642-1234 or send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. And Reggie McLeod, welcome back.
Oh, thank you, Larry. Good morning.
So it was up until about 20 years ago, there was a way of determining how old a fish was. You know, we looked at what? We looked at how long it was. Size sort of was a help. What else did we look at? Scales,
well,
I think.
Yeah, they counted the rings on the scales. But what happens, and you know, if you think about it, you could kind of anticipate that, as most animals kind of have a maximum size. As humans do, I haven't grown much for a while. And so the scales at a certain point weren't really getting much bigger, but it was adding rings still. And those rings were so close together, they really couldn't see them. And it took them a while to figure that out. And so they started looking for other ways to determine the age of fish. And when they did, they were surprised to find that some of them are living much longer than they had anticipated. And that's why the story, that's what I thought of when I first read the story, is that fish may be older than you. Even some of the older fishermen are going to catch fish older than them. So it kind of puts everything in a different light, you know, when you're out fishing.
Yeah, that atomic bomb test and the carbon 14-day dating came into play for that particular story. And I was interested. I was looking at the age of some of the fish, and a freshwater drum, they can be over 100 years old.
Yeah, that's unbelievable, isn't it? And I've seen commercial fishermen pull up huge drum from the Mississippi River. It's amazing how big they can get, but still 100 years old and maybe more. And there's a lot of fish in a lot of places they haven't looked at yet, too, so...
It's amazing. You know, you have really a beautiful piece of art on the current issue cover. Tell us about the art and how it's connected to effigy mounds.
Well, you know, just a little more broadly, and I've been thinking about fry bread ever since I listened to your last guest. We've been publishing for 27 years with a new issue that makes 27 years. And a year or so ago, I realized most of the stories we had done on Indian people were history stories, which is to say they were about dead Indians. And it kind of shocked me. I hadn't really thought that through. And I know Indian people who have stayed here, you know, Ho-Chunk people, Dakota people, that weren't removed, that resisted the removals or hid out or came back. And so I thought, well, let's do a series of stories about that, you know, because a lot of people talk about Indians in the past tense.
And yeah.
A lot of Indian people everywhere. And so we started that with the last issue about a Ho-Chunk family by DeSoto, Wisconsin, who kind of stuck around. And then in this new issue, it's kind of about the Effigy Mounds National Monument, which is a wonderful place to visit. It's across the river from Prairie du Chien in Iowa. And there are several hundred Indian mounds there. There are actually three different locations, but the main location has a great museum, and it's a wonderful hike. And they've been being more proactive to make connections with the Indian people, the descendants of the Indian people who built the mounds and who lived in that area. And the state of Iowa is named after the Iowa tribe, and most of those people are now in Nebraska, and that's one of the tribes they've been working with. And there's an art show up there in the museum right now with art by Iowa artists. And it's kind of looking at the idea of rewilding the landscape a little bit. In other words, restoring it more like it was when the native plants and animals were thriving there. And Iowa has been so changed by agriculture that there's getting to be kind of a movement to restore some of the places. And it's really appropriate to have Indian people involved with that process and to be, you know, part of the discussion of that. So that's what this art show at the Effigy Mounds is about.
Man, it is some, there's some beautiful work here.
Yeah, I like that cover. It really stands out on the magazine rack, I'll tell you that. And it is a beautiful cover, and it gets you thinking. You know, it's the sort of thing you think, now what is that, and what does that mean? And so some intriguing ideas, I think, that people are dealing with right now in this process that's going on.
Yeah, for sure. Reggie McLeod, our guest today, editor and publisher of Big River Magazine, talking with him about life along the Mississippi, and certainly welcome your questions or comments. I hope you'll join in at 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. You know, oak trees, they make an impression on whatever landscape they're in. Unfortunately, oak wilt has caused too many to be cut down. Tell us about the one in Lake City, Minnesota.
Yeah, that was kind of fun, because a lot of times you look at an old oak tree and you think, again, how old is it? It's kind of interesting. We have three stories about, we have old fish and an old oak tree and an old angler in this issue. But this old oak tree was on DNR land in Lake City, Minnesota, on Lake Pepin. And when they cut it down, they sent a slice of it up to the University of Minnesota to analyze it, to find out about its age. And then a retired doctor there from Mayo Clinic, who's written for us before, he's kind of a fun guy. He looked at that cross-section and kind of performed a post-mortem on it to analyze some of the things he found there, which included some bullets and remnants of nails and remnants of it being treated for oak wilt. And it's probably, it's probably a couple hundred years old. It's 201 to 206 years old is what they figure. So that was kind of fun too. And then he did research and tied, you know, the bullets and the former nail. It was just some rust left from the nail and that, into events that were happening there. There was a military base there back in the late 1800s, and he actually found an old photo that had the oak tree in there. And so it's really fun. He did a lot of work on this, and he kind of reads that tree like a book a little bit.
I thought it was a fascinating story. And, you know, your magazine isn't always just about, obviously, as we've been listening here, isn't always about the river itself, but what's along it and its history. It's fascinating stuff.
Yeah, we're kind of centered on the river in the Driftless area, and that kind of leads us to some of the bigger tributaries, too, like the Wisconsin River and the Chippewa River and the St. Croix. So we've kind of seen ourselves as reporting on the Driftless area, too, because that's really the area right around the stretch of river that we cover.
Yeah. And you mentioned an old fisherman, and you do have you have some fish stories in here. We'll get to Mary in just a second, but I wanted to mention the Freshwater Fishing Hall of Fame in Hayward. I'm a charter member of the Freshwater Fishing Hall of Fame.
You are. Cool.
Yeah, if you know that gigantic muskie that's there on the property, you can walk up
in. Did you catch that, Larry?
if you walk inside it, you can walk all the way to the top, right to the mouth. And if you get up there and you're looking out the mouth of the giant muskie, you look to your left, and along the inside of the jaw, there are names, and my name's right there.
Oh, neat. I'll look for it next time I'm in Hayward. I get up there pretty regularly. So that's fun.
It's a lot of fun, and it's an unusual place.
Yes. I love to fish, and fishing means a lot of different things to different people. And I have a good friend who collects rods and reels, and he has hundreds and hundreds of them. And on Friday, he was just talking to me about his collection. He's thinking of having a museum. And then on Saturday night, I was talking to a doctor friend of mine who's an avid trout fisherman. And, there's such different styles and gears and gear and fish and different ways to fish. It's really fascinating.
And you'll see it all in the Freshwater Fishing Hall of Fame.
Yes, indeed.
there's even a piece of driftwood with full of hooks. And I think they were all taken out of people. It looks like a porcupine. Uh-oh. And they were all taken out of people by one of the local doctors in Hayward. He'd take one out and he'd ask to put it in his piece of driftwood. And he took out a lot of hooks out of a lot of people.
Ouch. I know a few people that have been caught by the ear or even one by the nose one time.
And, it's not fun. Reggie McLeod, our guest, he's going to be with us right up till 12:30. I hope you'll join in at 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller. We'll be back right after the news. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller, and we're talking now about the Mississippi River and the area, the land around it, with our guest, Reggie McLeod. He's the editor and publisher of Big River Magazine. So, as we visit with him, what's your favorite place to visit along that area? What do you like to do there during the winter months? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, or send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. We'd love to hear from you. And we were talking, Reggie, about fish and the Fishing Hall of Fame, but there's some other stories in there. Story about Captain Ted Peck.
Yes. Well, Ted, we are proud to say, is about to be inducted into the Fishing Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
And he's a guide based out of New Albany, Iowa, which is just right on the Minnesota-Iowa border, across the river from DeSoto, Wisconsin, actually. And he does a lot of guiding from Wisconsin as well as New Albany. And he's indicted. I've been listening to the news too much. He's being inducted as a legendary guide, and he knows an awful lot about fish in the backwaters, and that's why he's been writing a lot of fish stories and fishing stories for Big River Magazine. He's a good storyteller as well as a very
darn good guide. Darn good guide as well. Well, somebody who probably doesn't need a whole lot of help when it comes to fishing is Mary Christophers, or Christopher?
Yeah,
the Fishing Machine.
Yes. And Ted wrote that story. He was just so excited about this story. He thinks, well, he knows that she's an awesome angler. You know, I don't know. That's kind of one of those awkward things with gender. You don't want to say fisherman, you know.
And, yeah.
You know, I try to say angler, but technically an angler is someone who fishes with worms. And I think Mary has fished in a lot of different ways. She's actually been a commercial fisher person, and she does it for fun ever since he was a child. And he tells a story about her being home babysitting for her younger brother when she was just a child, and sneaking off and making a fishing pole out of a willow and getting some twine that her mom had saved from the grocery store, the butcher shop, and using a safety pin for a hook, and going out and catching a fish and cleaning it and cooking it secretly. So there's no stopping someone like that. You know, she's destined to fish. And, a lot of good stories about her, too, you know. Of course.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I, you know, here we are getting it. It'll be sooner or later, there's going to be the water's going to become very hard.
Yes. And Ted wrote a story about that, too, for the next issue.
Mary, he talks about the guys coming, the fishermen coming out there. When she was on the ice pulling in fish and nobody else was catching any.
Yeah, yeah.
they all moved closer and closer.
Closer and closer to her. Yeah, and then the next time she was out there in a tent, so they didn't see her, and she overheard a couple of the fishermen talking outside the tent, and one of them was telling the other guy about this woman that was catching so many fish out there the other day, and he said, "She's a fishing machine," and that's... That's how she got the name.
She is the fishing machine. She sure is that.
Yeah.
Wow. You know, another article that caught my eye was the story from the Minneapolis Star Tribune about Peace Money Island. And you've got a story in there about that, the boy who started it. Explain that whole business.
Well, it's interesting. I worked as a freelance journalist for a long time. I wrote for both the Milwaukee papers when there were two, and the Madison paper, and USA Today, a bunch of papers. And you know, there just once in a while you stumble across a story, you just have to go, aha. And this is one of them. This is a young man who is 15 years old from Newport, Minnesota, which is just on the Mississippi, just a little downriver of the Twin Cities. And he's been rescuing bunny rabbits. He is kind of a bunny rabbit rescue service, and he tries to place them with foster families. And he has bought three islands in the Mississippi River near Newport, and his one of them he named Peace Bunny Island, and he named his nonprofit after that, called Peace Bunny Island Inc. And he trains people to take care of bunnies, and he's actually has 32 blue ribbons from the Minnesota State Fair for showing rabbits, exotic rabbits, and so on at the state fair. So that's one of those stories that gets a journalist salivating, actually. You think, wow,
well,
this is so weird, but so nice, you know, too, at the same time.
Well, you wonder how he wound up with three islands.
Yeah, well, he got a loan and bought these islands, and I'm not sure if he's populating. I know he has bunnies running around loose on at least one of them, and I have paddled by those islands and boated by those islands and stopped on them. They're pretty small, and I'm anxious to get back up there and go to Peace Bunny Island, because I didn't. That was before I think he got the islands. So it'd be kind of fun to go on an island that's full of bunnies, kind of like a weird dream or something.
So, Reggie McLaughlin.
I'll bring some carrots when I go.
There you go. Reggie McLeod, our guest today. He is editor of Big River Magazine. And they, of course, writes about life along the Mississippi River. He gets into some other rivers as well once in a while with his stories. You can join in. Maybe you got an experience to share or a question about the Mississippi itself. Give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. You know, it's not always the lightness either when it comes to some of the stories you had. The microplastics on the Mississippi River, the amount a lacrosse, UW lacrosse student found?
Yeah, did a research project and found a lot of microplastics in the water. And that's, you know, they've been finding a lot of those in the ocean, and they're finding them just about everywhere they look, actually. A lot of it's fibers, unfortunately, and I have a couple fleece vests and a couple fleece jackets, and every time I wash those, they shed little fibers that go in the water, and the sewage treatment plants cannot take those out, so they end up in the water, and you know, they're starting to find them in fish and so on, and they're not sure what the ultimate effect of that may be. And, of course, they're going to, like everything else that goes in the river, it ends up concentrating in the ocean then, too, because when it gets in the ocean, it's going to stay there. It's got no other place to go. So it's kind of rough, and I know I've been seeing more wool. It'd be good for the wool industry, probably. I think people are starting to wonder what to do about this. There are filters that you can get that will filter the discharge water from your washing machine and will filter those out so they don't go down the drain. But it's another one of those new things they're finding in the water.
And it was like he was, the researcher found, I think it was 7 to 11 pieces of plastic adrift in every cubic meter of water on the Mississippi.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, my goodness. Wayne in Marinette has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Wayne. Thank you for calling.
Hello. I would like to ask the guest today, what is the longest lived species on the upper Mississippi and or the Mississippi itself regarding as such like a sturgeon, snapping turtles, mud turtles, or salamanders?
Well, I don't know that they've determined that. I believe in this story, they said that the buffalo fish was the longest one they had found so far. And you don't see them, you don't catch them very often if you're sports fishing because they tend to eat plants a lot. And, you know, I think they'll take worms and so on if you're fishing with worms. I don't think they've done much testing with sturgeons. And the tough thing is this otolith, where they're aging them, they look at different layers. And this is kind of a pearly bone that's in the ear of fish. And they know a lot about sheep's head because sheep's head have a really huge otolith in proportion to their body, whereas other fish like sturgeon and that have really small ones in proportion to their body. So that's one reason they focus on sheep's head and some of the bigger fish. Also, people are reluctant to kill a big fish because you mentioned snapping turtles. I had a friend that was a commercial fisherman and he caught snapping turtles and I helped him clean turtles a couple times with automotive tools like vice grips and so on. And I like the taste of turtle meat, but every time I've been out where I have a large snapping turtle and I think, boy, I could kill this and cook it, and I like turtle meat. And then I think, well, this guy's too old. This guy is probably really old. I don't really want to kill it. I want to put him back in the water or her. And I think people feel that way with the fish, too, because they have to kill them to get this otolith out of their head. So I think we're still going to learn more. I think traditionally I was thinking of sturgeon, too, because that's generally what, when they talk about old fish, they talk about those
sturgeon,
5-6 foot sturgeons that they catch. But I don't know that they've done a lot of testing on them because they don't like killing them, and there are not that many of them. So I think it's going to be a while before we have a more complete kind of record of how long the fish live. They know a lot about sheep's head because people don't feel that guilty about keeping a large sheep's head, like they would probably with a sturgeon or a paddlefish or, you know.
Yeah, they had a buffalo, big mouth buffalo, up to, I think, 112 years old.
Yeah, yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, you got to show some respect for these fish now, really, if they're living that old. And as Larry said, it's an amazing process that they do. They can actually use the different bomb tests going back into the 50s and late 40s to date different layers in that ear bone, in that otolith. And that's how they're dating it. They go back to the first layers, which were laying on pretty thick, you know, initially. And, of course, they slow down as they get older. But this way they go to the oldest layer, which is right in the middle, and they date that. And they can tell from the levels of not even radioactive substances.
Carbon-14.
But carbon-14, and there are some other elements that they can kind of date tests from. So it's kind of an interesting process. But they're just scratched the surface now.
Yeah.
I wouldn't be surprised if the sturgeons live older than the buffalo fish. But
I bet you there's some that are 150 years old. I wouldn't.
Yeah. They look like dinosaurs. They look like they're about a million years old, but yeah.
There you go, Wayne. Thank you so much. We have another Wayne in Marshfield. Let's go there. Hi, Wayne.
Good afternoon, Larry and Reggie. Changing the subject a little bit, you're very familiar with all the dams and locks on the Mississippi River.
Yes.
And I'm wondering how practical it would be, especially this year, an awful lot of water and energy has gone down the river unused, and whether it would be practical to put a 4-foot, 6-foot, 8-foot diameter conduit around the end of those dams with a turbine and use that energy to generate electricity. I think it would be as practical as having a 20-by-30 roof with solar panels. You know, it would add to the grid.
Yeah?
Yeah, it seems that way, but it's complicated. And the big complication is those locks and dams were built only to enable shipping on the river. Now, there are a couple exceptions, one at Keokuk, way downriver, and Lock and Dam 1, up in Minneapolis, those were built to generate electricity. But because the other ones were, they were built to be used when the water's really low and they lower the gates, they come down from above and they raise the water that upstream of the lock and dam so that to maintain a 9-foot channel for the towboats and barges, which is what they need for a fully loaded barge. And when the water gets up to flood stage or even starts to get high, they start pulling those gates out. And by the time it reaches flood stage, they're legally obligated to have all of those gates out of the water completely, because if they were still in the water, even a little bit, that would create a liability if the flooding caused any damages to anybody upstream. So those dams are technically, and the Army Corps will tell you, those dams only have an effect on the river when the water is very low. So when the water is high, there's very little difference in elevation above and below the dam because the gates are all up. Now, one thing that happens is there are a lot of dikes that attach one end of the dam to the mainland somewhere, and some of those dikes are quite long. Some are more than a mile long, and those do constrict the river. But still not enough to get enough head to generate electricity. So if they were generating electricity, they'd have to do it when the gates are in the water. And the schemes, and they've tried several schemes, and they haven't figured out how to make this profitable. the ones they've one they've had where they back up kind of a barge into the gate and lower the gate and hold it in there, and it generates electricity. And that way, when the water, if the water gets high, they can get that barge out of the way so it doesn't hold back any water. It's not an obstruction. Another thing they've done are like underwater windmills.
Yeah.
Water mills. And they sink them in a spot, deep spot right below a dam usually, and hook those up. And they've had problems with those, with chopping up fish, for one thing, and also just servicing them and getting much electricity out of them. They did a bunch of tests up by Hastings, Minnesota, right before the St. Croix flows into the Mississippi up there, and that did not work out very well. So it seems like a good idea, but it's complicated because the dams weren't built for that. The one up in Minneapolis, they call it the Ford Dam because Henry Ford built that to generate electricity for a car plant he built there in the early part of the 20th century, and they used that. I think they had enough electricity from that dam to run the whole plant. And that dam is still there, and they're still generating electricity from that one. But that's a big, that's much larger than the dams around here. That has a fall of about, I don't know, it's about 40 feet, almost 40
feet. Yeah.
So it's a pretty dramatic dam. The ones down here generally are, you know, I don't know, 15 feet or, you know, 20 feet is kind of a lot for most of these dams. So that's a problem. They weren't built for it. They were just built for the shipping, to enable the shipping.
So there you go. Thank you so much for that question, Wayne. Appreciate it. Kathy wondered about the history of Gutenberg. She grew up in Wisconsin near Bagley and boated the river every weekend. And she loved Gutenberg. There were lots of empty oyster shells on the beach that had round holes drilled in them. Somebody told her there was a button factory in Gutenberg for many years. And I know you wrote a story about that, Reggie. Oh,
yeah, we've written a few. And Larry, if you're ever over there, they're going to spot you as a Wisconsinite if you say Gutenberg. You're supposed to say Gutenberg.
But I was thinking about the Bible, I guess.
Yes, Gutenberg, yes, no, it's Gutenberg over there. And it's a German. It was mainly settled by Germans. And Gutenberg and many of the river towns, Lansing, Iowa, Prairie du Chien, a lot of those places had button factories, and a lot of people went out and harvested mussel shells on the river, and then they would clean the meat out of the mussel shells, and they'd sell them to a place that made buttons, and they had drills that would drill out circular blanks for buttons. And so those left the shells full of holes, and I have some on my windowsill of my office. And I found them right here by the railroad tracks in Winona. I found them, you know, all along river towns. You can just see them sometimes. They were used as fill. And the capital, the pearl button capital of the river, was Muscatine, Iowa, right below the Quad Cities. And they... most of the buttons in the world were made
right there,
the stretch of the river, and most of those were made in Gutenberg. The alleys were full of those shell blanks, and most of the people were working in the button industry. So those plastic buttons you probably have on your shirt right now are made to look like pearl buttons. That's why they look that way. They're supposed to look like they were cut from shell, and that's what put them out of business, with the plastic buttons.
Oh, man. Reggie, always a pleasure. Big River Magazine available. Go to bigrivermagazine.com. Mm-hmm. You're going to find out how to get copies of the magazine. Reggie, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Larry. Boy, it sure went fast today.
It did.
Sure.
Yeah. Bigrivermagazine.com, the place to go. Well, Melinda Myers joins us for Garden Talk tomorrow to answer your gardening questions. And say, if you'd like to hear more about other guests on the show, check out our new blog. It's called WPR.org/Larry to see what's there. In the meantime now, thank you all for listening. Please stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network.